And Susan, the question that I ask everybody to get started is your earliest memory of the group or the park or whatever that your interface is with life at that time as we were growing up. What's your earliest memory?
I guess my earliest memories were walking home. No, even before that, we had a large number of kids on my block. So we had a really huge block on Vandeveer. And for the first year or two, we could take the city bus to school. We still had bus passes. So we as a group would all go up to the bus stop. And we'd get on a city bus and we'd get to Lourdes. And I remember those being the most fun. When it was wintertime, we'd be throwing snowballs at each other. And we all got off as a group and came home. And I lived towards the end of the stop. But like, I was in the middle of the block, and most of the kids were up the block. So as we got down, we dwindled the numbers until we got home. So that's my earliest memory of the whole Lourdes experience, was just going to and coming from school.
What grade were you in when you were traveling?
First grade. And back then, I remember we were three blocks away from 109, and 109 was our kindergarten. And all of us talk about this. This is really funny because I don't know if you remember Phyllis Murray, and she married Stephen Golden. And she's my best friend, always been my best friend. Here in South Carolina, they live a mile away from me.
Okay, so Steve Golden, as in Jackie Golden's
Jackie's brother. And actually, I see Jackie when she comes down and visits. And George Pinero lives up the block from me. He's like four houses away. So a bunch of us have kind of, and George just bought a house down here with his wife, but they're not coming down for another year. And Karen Fitzpatrick, by the way, has a house here also, but she's renting it until she's ready to retire. So a bunch of us have made it down here from Queens Village. But that's a side note. That's my earliest memory of Lourdes, but 109, all of us, when we went to kindergarten, our parents let us walk three blocks by ourselves as kindergartners to school and back.
Spectacular.
So, I love it. 5 years old and you're walking to school in the city.
But that was that time. Did you ever feel unsafe or?
No. In fact, there was a house that had a collie, I remember. And that was the big fun of the day. You'd go to the house. The collie was always out in the morning. And when we came back home, and we'd stop by and always, and sometimes, I'm walking by myself sometimes, and I would just pet the collie and go to school. Mrs. Brown and Mrs. Lane were the kindergarten teachers, and they were just wonderful people. And then I had, going into Lourdes, I had Sister Christina Maria, who, my first experience, you'll love this. I was an avid reader, even at a young age. I was reading comics, the Sunday comics and stuff, by the time I was in kindergarten. So by the time I was in first grade, I had a above average reading level for first grade. And we were reading those Dick and Jane books. You know how they all make fun of them? We actually had them as books. Do you remember?
Yeah, I do.
And I would always read ahead because a lot of kids didn't really read well. So I would kind of read ahead because I was getting bored sitting there with the slow pace. And she pulled me out of my chair one day, and she never hit, but she screamed at me for reading ahead and made me stand up the whole class while the whole reading time was going on, so I couldn't touch my book. A kid who loved to read, this was like, nowadays, I mean, like I told you, I was a teacher by trade. If I had a kid like that, I'd give them a different book. I'd give them a book that was more their reading level, but because I wasn't.
Or give them two books.
Right, exactly. But because I was way ahead of the class, it irked her. And she was a wonderful otherwise, but I'll never forget that feeling of, oh my God, I have to be like everybody else. That was the first, I guess, inclination that you had to fit in, or we were going to beat you to fit in, or yell at you to fit in, or be whatever, you know, to fit in. You couldn't do better than or you couldn't do worse than the average in that school. And then from that, you know what, we took the bus through second grade, because in second grade I had Mrs. McDonald, I think was her name, and she was the first lay teacher that I had. And I used to take the bus with Charlie Gertzberger, and Charlie Gertzberger was the funniest kid I ever met at that time. And he would make me laugh like crazy. And I just remember him because of that. And then he moved away, so I never saw him again. But he, if I ever hear his name again or ever hear know anybody that ever meets him, I have to just say, he, all I remember is laughing through second grade because of Charlie Gertzberger.
Wow.
And then third and fourth were like, okay, we're here kind of thing. I don't even remember my third grade teacher's name. But I, that's when we started walking home. And I would walk home with Jamie Lombard. Was that her name? And Kathy was her neighbor. And I'd walk home to their house. We lived the last block that was in Our Lady of Lourdes district. Around the corner from me went to Immaculate Conception. Was it Immaculate Conception? I think it was, whatever it was, around the corner. So we never knew anybody from the around the corner further down. It was everybody that went to Lourdes. So it was all the blocks in front of us, but anything behind us, we didn't know because they went to a different church. So, which was weird if you think about it. But in that radius of walking, what the nicest thing I remember is I could walk all the way home. And I knew somebody on every block. So if anybody bothered me, I knew what house to run to. Not that anybody ever bothered me. What?
Yeah. Interesting.
Right?
You know,
that was the safety net.
Yes. And someone that I've been talking to reminded me how important those walks were because of all the talking that went on. And,
yeah.
And you processed your day and you processed what happened at school and everywhere else and how important that was to our growing up to be able to process like that.
No, that's true. I think because when especially when the crazy things happen, we could testify and agree that it was crazy, even though there was nothing we could do about it.
Yes.
You know, especially on report card day. Report card days were the worst.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah, even if you had a great report card, you knew the kid that didn't have it. You just so felt for the kid that did not, especially the boy that did not get it, because they would get beat in front of you.
Yes.
We were terrorized. We really were. And I laugh because, like, when I lived in Texas, Debbie Gorey moved down there. And she was she's 2 years older grade-wise. But, you know, we would catch up. And her memories of Our Lady of Lourdes was just, like, heavenly. And I would be like, I remember it so differently because I really felt, especially later on when I realized everything was regurgitation and memorization. And if you couldn't do that, you basically failed. And you couldn't have an opinion. It wasn't until high school that the world kind of opened up more. I guess it was really cool, too, because with Van Buren, we went to school with the first ninth grade. It was the Catholic school kids and the Jewish kids because their school ended at eighth grade, too. So and then in 10th grade, the black kids came in. So it was like, what's a Baptist? What's a Presbyterian? It was like the world was filled with so many other people that I didn't know existed prior.
Right.
Which was and that in itself was an eye opener. It was like, wow, we most recently, about 2 years ago, I took a memoir class just because I felt like my writing skills were I was losing them because I wasn't teaching anymore. And I was writing about Queens Village. And one of the things I said, if you think of where I came from as the Russian stacking dolls. And everybody thinks, all right, yeah, you're from New York City, but we're really, if you pull out further, it's New York City, then you go to Queens, then you go to Queens Village, then you go to Our Lady of Lourdes, and then was my street. So the two biggest things was Vandeveer and Our Lady of Lourdes. The rest of the backdrop really didn't matter until much older in life. And I felt like we lived in a village, even though it was in New York City.
Yes. 100%. Did you get to the east side of Springfield Boulevard much? You know, Springfield Boulevard was like a river. You know, you were on one side of the river or the other, right?
Yes. I you know, when you say the east side, you mean the 33 side?
Yeah, the PS 33 side, yeah.
Yeah. You know, And I think about it a lot, and there's a couple of reasons why. I think, first of all, on my block, the only two people my age was myself and Bobby Green. And older me knows that, and I can't even verify this, but Bobby Green's parents got divorced. So there must have been a lot of turmoil in the house because, you know, nobody got divorced back then. But Bobby Green used to ring my doorbell, and he did this up until the year Joe Howard, sixth grade. He would ring my doorbell. He'd count to 10. And if I didn't run and try and get away from him, which he usually caught me, and he beat the crap out of me. I was his punching bag. And everybody laughs. Nobody would ever come to my defense. My parents would say, oh, he just has a crush on you. And I'm like, I don't need a guy that beats me. I don't need a guy that beats. So I automatically stayed away from wherever Bobby Green was the rest of my life. Because that was like, you know, and he was the only kid my age. So I had no other block friends that were in my grade. My friends were a year ahead of me, like Phyllis Murray Golden, and Karen Fitzpatrick, who was 2 years ahead of me. And it took us a long time to figure out that Phyllis is only 6 months older than me. But I always used to think she was a year ahead because of school. But those were my friends. So I had friends I hung out with at school. And then Vanderveer is a mile from Our Lady of Lourdes. So for me to go to 33 is an even bigger walk.
Right. Right.
So, and I had enough, Patty Connell, I don't know if you remember the Connells. She was also Phyllis's grade. So those were the girls I hung out with. And, you know, they were on my block. That's why I say Vanderveer was a huge part of my life, because the older kids back then used to play with the younger kids. During the summer, when we were little, nobody had more than one car, and everybody kept their cars in the driveway. So the street was pretty empty, and it was a one-way street. So the I remember Brian Connell and, like, Michael Green, who was also a little bit older. Those boys, Marty Perchak, who I don't know if you knew because he was Jewish and he went to public school. But those boys would, play what's the game where you would throw the ball to one boy would throw to the other boy, and in between it, you'd be in the middle, and if they tagged you, you were out.
Running bases.
Okay. So, I mean, this is the kind of stuff and to play that you need kids. So they would grab everybody, and we would do kick the can. We would do this kind of, tag where you'd split up into two teams. And if you got, it was like a freeze tag, you got frozen. And then you had to go to the jail, and somebody else would have to run down from your team and freeze you all, like run down and hit all your hands to get out. We played, you know, all these wonderful games. I can't even remember. We even played, we played the stupid games like hopscotch, and we played where we would fill up the soda bottle caps with crayon. We'd melt the crayon in, and we would have races with the soda bottle caps on ledges. And we would go pool hopping. So our block was pretty tight as far as we weren't age specific or grade specific. Does that make sense? Until we got older and the older kids started to go out dating and the younger ones didn't.
Right.
That's when things kind of changed. But when I was young, there was no reason. My mom would kick me out and all of us out and go come back for lunch or whatever. And we'd be out on the block busy.
And she didn't know where you were.
Nope.
And she didn't care.
Nope.
She wasn't worried in the least. Yes.
Not at all. And, and as long as we were back and we have to for dinner, like they all would come out yelling. You'd hear your name yell and you go, okay, gotta go. And you'd run. And if you missed the yelling, then you'd get in trouble.
Right. We used to use the street lights. When the street lights went on, you had to be home. That was the deal.
We had. The streetlights, you had to be on had to be right around near the block, near the house, but we could stay out till the ice cream man came.
Oh, good humor.
Yep. And the good humor guy, this is funny. The good humor guy, my mom was really good friends with him because she was a coin collector. So he'd hang out in front of my house and they'd exchange coins.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's funny.
It was that kind of silly stuff. So yeah, my block was not, I mean, we were all Lord's kids for the most part, but, We like it, when they do a Vanderveer thing, the older kids still get together and they do their stuff. They're, you know, Jay Green, Michael Green, Brian Connell. I'm just trying to think. And older, because there were older kids even to that. We had almost 100 kids on our block.
Yes. And, isn't that amazing?
Yeah. So it was like there was no reason to really go anywhere else. And then when I got to that age, I was already, like, I was always the youngest in the group I hung with. So, like, when I met my husband, Julio, I met him when I was going into eighth grade. And he was already going into being a junior at St. Francis Prep. And everybody I knew I was the baby. And his brother, who was like 2 years older, was the oldest. So he was already like 18, 17, 18. There was a huge group I was hanging with, but I was the baby of it. So you guys, when you guys hung out, I was probably, what you guys were doing at 8th and 9th grade, I was probably, or 10th grade, I had already kind of been doing. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So, yeah, and again, I didn't have those girlfriend connections until much, and actually, out of everybody, I became friendlier with Jackie because of just the marriage thing and stuff like that. And it's really funny how some stories came out afterwards. Like, I used to think Jackie just didn't want to be friends with me, but I found out later on in life, Jackie's very shy.
I'm not surprised.
I was always like, okay, she's just, you know, because it was just, I mean, I'm hanging out with your brother, but, you know, you don't want to. And it was later on in life that I found out she was very shy. And I went, that makes a lot more sense, you know? So, yeah, my memories going back that far. Sixth grade was an important year for me. Like I said, I felt like I was floundering. And this is where
you had mentioned Joe Howard.
Yeah. Joe saved me because Bobby stopped beating me up. Joe wouldn't let anybody make fun of me. That's the year I got chickenpox. And Tommy Shaughnessy, who we had a weird love-hate relationship, Tommy and I. I went to high school with him, too. And Tommy would like to belittle. Tommy had a way of being able to belittle people. And Joe would never let him belittle me, especially when I got the chickenpox and came back to school. These are the things I kind of remember. I just remember feeling a lot safer around Joe than I did. It was a very vulnerable time, and he made it good for me, at least at school, until I got home. And then we had my father's medical issues to deal with, whether he was even home or he was in the hospital. It was a very, you know, as a teacher, I understand it now. And I was lucky I could separate the two, and it didn't. School for me was an escape from the craziness that was going on at home, even though school wasn't probably the most fun place to be at. It saved me from a couple of hours. It gave me sanity, more sanity. At least I knew what the rules were. And I knew how to not get in trouble with the nuns. Although eighth grade, at this point, eighth grade, I'm dating Jules for a while, a couple of months, and he gave me his high school ring. And I'm wearing his high school ring in eighth grade. And I get called down to Sister Deirdre, who was like, you're too young to be dating a high school boy, especially a junior, and da 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 da. And then she looks at the ring and she goes, oh, he's a prep boy, go back to class. And I went, thank you. And that was the end of that. So it was the hypocrisy I couldn't handle, the hypocrisy. The best one, were you in Mrs. Johnson's class at all?
No, but I know that was a 3 class, right?
Yeah.
I remember her well.
But yeah, she was wonderful. Especially, I had her for, that's who I had for 6th grade, and then she moved up to 7th grade. So I had her for 2 years. And in 7th grade, we were on the church side. And this, again, was the hypocrisy that this was right in my face, hypocrisy. Crazy Joe Gallo had died from the mafia, and he was, I think, a hitman, but he was a really bad guy. And because of that, Our Lady of Lourdes said, we can't do the funeral in the church. So we're going to hold it outside the church. because Crazy Joe Gallo's family gave a lot of money. And we are in class, and the windows are open because it's like a beautiful April, May, June day. I don't even remember, but it was in the spring. And we're hearing the whole funeral. And I'm like, this guy killed people, and you're still giving him a Catholic funeral, just not in the church. How hypocritical is that? I mean, how crazy is that? So I'm thinking to myself, you could be really bad, but as long as you have money, you can get away with it.
You buy the bingo board.
It was like, I remember that distinctly. And the other thing I remember, and I don't know why, I guess I always felt kind of stuck there. And as a kid, I remember when we go through history and learning all about the Mississippi River and everything west. And in my entire life, I never thought I would, because where did you go? We went up to like Pennsylvania. We never really went out of like maybe a little further than the tri-state area for vacations. You'd go upstate. You know, we didn't go anything too crazy. We didn't have a lot of money. So I never thought I'd get past what I knew, you know, in the Northeast. And then we ended up moving to Texas when I was in my early 30s with my two kids. And we did a lot of car trips. I've been to, out of the 48 states here, I've been to 44 of them. And we got an RV and we travel. I love learning about this country and parts of it. And I don't mind moving and living in other parts of it. I just, wherever I am, I want to take advantage of it. But every time, and we've done this hundreds of times now, every time we cross the Mississippi, I get so excited. I used to wake up my kids if they were sleeping. I'm like, we are crossing the Mississippi. You know what that means? That means we're on the west side. And they all think I'm crazy because they grew up, you know, with a lot of traveling, with their dad traveling. We used to have like a world map, and we'd put stars on the countries that dad went to and stuff. And then my son was in fourth grade and my daughter was in second grade. We had the opportunity to take him over to England. So I took him over there. They don't remember much of it, but I have pictures. I have proof that I took. but we went like everywhere. We got an RV. We lived in Chicago. Suburbs, the real suburbs, but we were only three states away from Mount Rushmore, and yeah. We had an RV, and I said, we're going. So we did all the Badlands, we did all, because to me it was like, I never thought I'd be here. I never thought I'd be in this place, or I never thought I'd see Mount Rushmore in my life. I've never been to Canada because it was a 12-hour drive from New York, but we moved to Columbus, Ohio, and it's only a 6-hour drive. So guess how many times we went to Canada. So, but I felt like I want to say it was part of that upbringing of being in Queens Village. There was this wonderful cocoon of a village that kept you safe. I never felt threatened but at the same time, it's a cocoon that kept you there. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think we were New Yorkers, like the New Yorker poster. Which was, you know, there's New York, and then there's the Mississippi River, California, and Japan. Yes. You know, the perspective was why leave if you got everything you'll ever need right here?
Oh my gosh! Yes, when the first time we moved to Texas, you thought we were moving outside of the world. I mean, you thought we were going like to Australia. Everybody was like, why? What's there? And it was like the best experience of my life to leave. And partly because I didn't realize it till a lot later. I think it's a gift I gave our kids too, or we gave our kids, because New York, in Keller, Texas, they were big fishes in little ponds. And in New York, we were all little fishes in big ponds. When you're doing your best, you're competing with the best of people that move there from other places who were totally the best there. So you're competing with the best of the best of the best. And right. When you leave there and you realize that it's okay to be a big fish in a little pond, because it's very hard to be a big fish in a big pond. You know, it was just a gift to my kids that the level of competition wasn't as staggering, even just to get into high schools or get into, you know, the competition level was just so much. It wasn't severe, and it wasn't. How do I put it? I guess one of the ways I could say it is the best way I can say it is New York weddings are insane. They're insane. They're insane. But you know what? That's what we grew up with. And that's what we were thinking. And that's how it's supposed to be. And then you leave and the rest of the world does it such on a more low key, more intimate, or the rest of the, you know, the, it's just, maybe Chicago is insane also, but a lot of places we moved to, it was very different. Like giving money's an insult. You were supposed to get a gift, you know? So just learning that there's other ways that you could flourish, and it didn't have to be the New York way, was a wonderful way was wonderful for me to learn from and to be a part of. And I think that's one of the reasons why I like Texas so much, because Texas also had the attitude of, you know, you weren't born here, but we're ready to adopt you.
That's nice. You know? I've never heard that before.
Yeah, it was, and like my kids, every third year they had to take Texas history at school, and it would be like how Texas, you know, dealt with World War II, or how, you know, it was just really cool. And I know more Texas history than I do of New York history. And there's such a pride of being a Texan, even if you're adopted, that like you'll go to somebody and you'll go, hey, that name sounds German, your last name. And they'd go, I don't know. It was my daddy's name. It was my daddy's daddy's name. And then his daddy's name. But after that, I can't tell you where we came from because we're Texans. So when you come from New York, where everybody has a second identity, because you automatically know you're Irish, German, or Italian, or, you know, Puerto Rican. And in there, it was just, it was really funny. It was like, no, I'm just Texan.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
And then when we moved back to New York, we ended up moving back to Merrick, we ended up married and lived in East Meadow before we went to Texas. And when we came back to Merrick, we always thought Merrick was with Eisenhower Park. It was like the place to come back to, right? And we get there and we're on the peninsula. And I had just left a community in Keller, Texas. It was just up and coming. Our community, you name it. We had an Iranian Cuban couple that lived across the street. We had a Black couple that lived next door. My best friends were Jewish couple from Missouri. We had a gay couple raising two kids. I had a Mormon PTO president with a whole bunch of Baptist people that were down there. And I didn't even know Baptists consider Mormons like the devil, but down there, everybody got along. So I had just come from this huge melting pot of just a school community and the subdivision we lived in. And I go back to New York and we moved in on the Jewish side and everybody thought we were crazy. And I was like, okay, where are we supposed to live? It's a nice house. It's a nice neighborhood. It was just very startling to me that we aren't, New York City's not a conglomerate of people. Everybody may meet in New York City, but they go home to their individual communities that are just like themselves. And if you stir the pot or you're different, it becomes a very big sore thumb, I guess.
Yeah, know. I think the city has ghettos. We don't call them that, but it, like you said, it's essentially people of a particular ilk live together to be comfortable. You know, you can pick out neighborhoods, and the majority of people that live there are a certain person. You know, whether yes. They're Black or they're Jewish or, like you said, Irish or Italian, people tend to go back home. Not so much anymore, but certainly when we were growing up, that was a big separating line.
And we were just like, you know what? We know there's a different, and my husband, of course, was commuting an hour and a half into the city. So one way. And in Texas, he was always like 15 minutes away. So if the kids got sick and I couldn't do something, you know, we could have lunch with the kids. I could work in the kids' school. And I went to Merrick and, here's the first thing, the school district that we came from, it was a K through fourth, and kindergartners did Hanukkah for the holidays. First graders did Chinese New Year's. Every grade did something different, and not until you were in fourth grade, the last grade, could you do Christmas, because most of the people were Christian. So there was this wonderful celebration of all different cultures in this tiny school district. We get up to Merrick, they're getting rid of, they want to get rid of Mother's Day and Father's Day. They've gotten rid of all the holidays because it's too much of an argument with everybody. Now they want to get rid of Mother's Day and Father's Day. And I'm like, oh my gosh, we went from such a inclusive community to one where it's like, we don't want to educate anybody on anything, you know? And I went like, wow, they wouldn't bring in a cafeteria in Merrick, even though it was a very wealthy school district and one of the best on Long Island, because Freeport was next door. And if they brought in a cafeteria, they'd have to offer free lunch. And if they offered a free lunch and busing never came back, the people from Freeport might be there. So they did not offer hot lunch on the possibility of other people from other communities coming into their school. And I was just like, the last school we went to, it was $1.50. The kids had three choices. I don't think I made them lunch the whole time we were there. I was like, yeah, go pick something from school. Yeah, because, yeah, free lunch existed. But, and I kept saying to myself, you know, you have a lot of single mothers in this community who could probably use a free lunch program. You know, and they're barely getting by. But they didn't want to do it. They were so intent on keeping their community just as it is since 1961.
So you had mentioned that you're still connected with Jackie. Who yes. else from the community are you still in touch with?
Well, the Paneras and the Goldens and Phyllis, Karen, Fitzpatrick, but these are kids that aren't necessarily from that group. That's about it, I think, from there.
But you're still in touch with Joe, right?
Oh yeah. Well, on Facebook it makes it really easy.
Oh, okay.
You know, you do. I mean, like, there are people I'm friends with on Facebook. Joe, I actually contacted because I felt I was at a point in my life at some point where I really wanted to reach out to people, and thank them for, you know, there's that saying that there's a person's in your life for a reason, a season, or a lifetime. And they were in my life for that season that I needed something good. So I don't know how I actually reached out to him in the beginning, but I wanted him to know. And I had told him personally, I said that he just helped me be part of who I am today. At a crucial point in my life, my husband's the same thing. He, at a crucial part in my life, he was there to, I won't say the word rescue me, but they were like my little guardian angels, you know, that just helped me get through.
And I don't think we always know that, in some subtle way, but in a very positive way, just our presence with another person provides them just that little bit of strength that they need to push them over the top and get through.
That's it. And I will tell you, make it you. And Richie Gunn. No, in seventh grade, you guys, the roof jumping and the whole, my friendship with Joe was gone in sixth grade, and I needed, especially at school, again, somebody there to just, because I didn't have the girlfriends at school, I didn't, and you guys filled in the gap, and then Richie. Richie was funny. Richie was hysterical. In high school, the thing I remember most about Richie is he was so into the punk rock scene, and he was always trying to convince me that it was, you know, this great music. And I was like, Jules had gotten me into Yes and Queen and all that. And I'm like, I don't see it. I see it a step backward. So he brought me to a Ramones concert.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He bought me a ticket and brought me to. He's like, I'm going to prove to you. And he brought me, and I was deaf for 2 days. I swear I couldn't hear things for 2 days. And that's what I remember of the Ramones concert. But he was a, and Tommy Shaughnessy in high school was amazing also. And Tommy Nanny too was a little on the funny side there. They kind of, because these are the guys I ended up walking to school with.
Yeah, Tommy Nanny lived up by you.
Yeah, so like Tommy Shaughnessy and Tommy Shaughnessy and Tommy Nanny and Louis DeLillo. Actually, I stay in touch with Louis DeLillo too. He's in Florida. And that's very recent that I actually found him. I don't remember how I did that either, but I was like, they were the guys that I just kind of went to school with. Because again, my girlfriends were a year older than me or 2 years older than me. So we weren't in the same grade level. We weren't in the same classes. So high school, it was easier that way because, you know, you changed and you had a different group of kids in every class. So it didn't really matter. But in Lourdes, you know what? Me and Cynthia Davila, we developed a lot earlier than the rest of the girls. So we were just different because of that, I think, in a lot of ways.
I remember that. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, like, McGough used to not let me get changed in the classroom. For gym, I'd have to go downstairs and get undressed in the gym because she didn't want me getting undressed in front of the boys. That I remember. And that was that wonderful time. What can I say? Anyway, what other questions do you have?
One of the things that I ask people is best friends. Now, did you have any best friends growing up? Someone that, and again, we all usually had many, or we were much more of, I had lots of friends, but I didn't have any best friends, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
What was your experience?
My best friend has always, really through the years, has been Phyllis Murray. We were born 6 months apart, two houses away from each other. She lived all her life on Long Island until she retired here. But we had stayed close no matter where I lived. We'd have a phone call, whether it was a weekly or a monthly or whatever. And we would try, if I got up to New York, we'd see each other. Eventually she visited us a couple of times. And then she got a place down here in South Carolina as a vacation place, a townhouse. And at that point, I think we were at the end of Illinois and then moving into Ohio. So we would come down here. The guys would play golf. And then it became couples weekends. And at some point, I think we were down here like 4 or 5 times a year meeting them. Oh. So when it came time to, at that point, she's like, oh, you need to get a place down here. And I'm like, no, I'm paying off 2 colleges right now because I had kids 2 years apart. So it was a very expensive time. And but they said, no, to retire. And I kept thinking, I don't know where I'm going to retire. And then when my last one finished college and did not come home either, neither child came home. That one stayed in Texas and the other one has moved around a lot. And he was in the Midwest. He was going to Wisconsin. So we said, okay, the kids aren't coming home. They're doing pretty well in their careers. Where do we want to end up? And Phyllis and I, we decided we were born together, we'll die together. So we almost bought houses next door to each other, but that didn't work out. So she lives about a mile away. She's been down here about 5 years. We've been here about 7. And Karen Fitzpatrick, who was our third person in that wheel, she's still up in New York. She's still working. And I think she's hoping to be down here maybe next year.
No kidding.
Yeah. So the three people, the three of us grew up. Karen, it was my house. Karen was right next to me. And then Phyllis. So we have been friends through life.
So that's one of those common threads that I was telling you about before. Yes. That I think developed because of the culture of New York at that time.
Yes.
Fostered this. Now, we know how fragile relationships are. And yet, through all of this, you chose to keep that relationship, and so did they. They, you know, you need two people to both agree that this is important. Otherwise, it falls apart. And I think it's just remarkable how many of us have friendships from, you know, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, the neighborhood that still, you know, still exist today?
Well, I think part of it is like Phyllis lost a brother when we were in our teens. And I had a sick dad, Annie McNeely. I used to be great friends with her because the two of us were going through some. She, her dad died. This was like later on, like after high school, when I was in college. And then my dad died. There was a connection of those deaths. But for Phyllis and I, we've always been friends. But I think both of us having to deal with, and then my sister passed away. Not that we talk about it much. But we both had those turmoils that most of the people in Queens Village did not, which also, you know, I don't remember who it was. I went back to the reunion. Was it the 20th year or the 25th year reunion? I was living in Texas at the time, but I said, I got to go see these people and see what's become of them. And I don't remember who I was talking to. And I thought she had like the best life. Growing up is, you know, because I'm looking at it from my dad is sick. I don't even know if he's home when I get, I was a latchkey kid and I was babysitting my younger sister and my younger brother if my dad wasn't available. But there were days I'd come home and he wouldn't be there. Someone took him to the hospital, you know? So when I would open up the door, you know, you go, hello, and hopefully you'd get a hello back. And if you didn't, that meant a whole different thing. Yeah, because my mom was working. So that experience when you look at everybody else and you're saying, God, they're laughing, they're having a great time. They have no idea what it is to have a terminally ill person in the house and what that means to have a bed in the living room. Like you bring somebody home and there's a bed in the living room because they can't go up the stairs. Right. And then when I went to that reunion and I don't know who it was, to find out that her parents were total alcoholics. And barely functioning alcoholics. And I went, wow, from my view, from my window, you had everything. Not knowing they went through another, you know, their own turmoil, their own kind of hell.
Yeah.
That was not their fault. So Phyllis and I were very close because we could see each other's hell. You know, being two doors down, everybody knew everybody's business. And I think part of that just solidified the fact that her only sibling died. And when my sister died, particularly, you know, and then you're getting married the next year and, you know, it's like she should have been my maid of honor. But Phyllis, you know, is my maid of honor who would have been in the bridal party. But these things kind of start to solidify. And we are as close as two people can be. We are sisters in so many senses. Now, I've had a sister, so I know what it really is. We're as close as you can be and not be biologically sisters. Does that make sense?
Yes, makes great sense. But again,
it's the tragedy. It's the tragedy that does it.
Yes, but I don't think that's the experience of most people today, meaning you're very fortunate to have someone that's totally unrelated to you and yet it is as close as being relations.
Yes. But I want to say part of it is and maybe that's why I hung out with older kids too, because I felt, especially what I was going through, there was nobody I knew that was going through what I was going through and could relate, because that's another thing that pushed me into being, I won't say mature, because I wasn't mature, but I was pushed into a different mindset. Like when you don't know if someone's going to, but my dad died a total of 3 times. You know, he kept coming back the other 2 times. So when he died the 3rd time, it didn't hit me for a while because I was like, oh, he's going to come back. You know, he died. Somebody resuscitated. When I got to the hospital, when he died the 3rd time, my sister literally had to go and see the body because she didn't believe him. She's like, no, somebody resuscitated him. You know, so when you're living in that mindset that this can change in a moment when you're dealing with when you realize how fragile every day could be, as opposed to somebody who's still innocent and doesn't know. It's, I don't know if you played, I couldn't go back to playing certain games because I wasn't a kid anymore. I was pushed into adulthood a lot sooner than a
lot
of
people. How old were you when your dad passed?
I was actually, well, you got to go back to the terminally ill. So we were fifth grade when he was terminally ill, and he should have died. And he did die once at that point. They only gave him 6 months. So, like, we came home every New Year's because we didn't know if this would be the last New Year's we'd be spending with my dad. So no matter what I did, I was home at 12 o'clock to celebrate New Year's with my dad. And then I also dealt with a mom who was severely depressed over this for years, who couldn't handle a lot of this and would kind of just retreat to her room and read murder mysteries. So during that time, it was me, my sister, and my brother, and I'm the oldest. So who's cooking dinner? You know, who's, you know, kind of thing. My dad died when I was 19, and I was going into my junior year of college, and I dropped out because I couldn't deal with it. And then in the household, you have, like, my sister and I, we wanted to find, get some, we wanted to move on, so we went to grievance counseling. We really wanted to get through this. We didn't want to live our life. And my mother and my brother were the opposite. They just got stuck in it. So now we're living as a four people in a house, and two of us are trying to crawl our way out of the grief, and two of them are just wallowing in it, you know? So, and then 2 years later, my sister passed away because she had leukemia, you know? She was diagnosed and died within 3 months. So it became a very, these are the things, and I always say for Phyllis and I, we've been through the deaths, the births, the marriages, we've been through it all. And we're still here for each other.
It's so remarkable. It's remarkable. And at the end of the day, it all boils down to that you had somebody in your life. And because they were outside your family and didn't have to be in your life, it's in some ways even more important and more meaningful.
Yeah.
Because they chose you.
Yes.
They did not have to be connected to you, and they chose to, over a period of what's now 50 years, 55 years, something like that.
Yeah. Oh, no, Phyllis and I are like 63 years. My husband and I are 50 years this year. That's funny too, because he's the same way. I will tell you, he totally rescued me. In fact, we were broken up. We broke up after 5 years. But he was still kind of staying in touch with me. And the day my dad died, he drove us to the hospital. He was with us when he died. And we weren't even dating at that point. But he was also my hero. He was always there when I needed him. You want to hear a weird story? I used to go to Hunter College. So I'd have to take the bus and the train into the city. And my mom worked in Long Island City for Honeywell Securities. My husband worked there part-time because he was actually out in Farmingdale going to school during the week, and he would work there on the weekends. So my mom got him the job while we were together, and we were broken up at this point. But one day I was running late, and I said, you know what, let me take a ride with you to work, and I'll jump on the train right there in Long Island City, and I'll get in quicker than I will if I take a bus and all my other trains. So I did that. I go down the stairs in Long Island City to the subway station. Who comes out? But my husband, Julio. And it was like we reconnected. And from that point, it was just very bizarre. That's how we ended up, I think, getting back together, or close to it. We started kind of seeing each other at that point. We were broken up for like 2 years. But it's just weird things like that. I love weird things like that. And for me to be at that subway station at the exact moment as him was just totally out of the norm. So I always say there's always these little angels up there that are watching me and making sure I've got that safety net or whatever. But yeah, the craziness.
Well, we're out of our time today.
Which is wonderful. And I hope I didn't talk too much.
No, to the contrary. And I would love to talk to you again. I'm going to send you the transcript because I always give people the opportunity to read it and say, I want to change that or whatever, and we'll change it in the transcript. Can't change it in the audio, but we can change it in the transcript if you feel that way. And if you know of anybody who would like to participate. I mean, I got your information from Joe. So,
yeah. And then when I got his text, it was really weird. I was like, okay. He's like, I have to talk to you about something. I'm like, okay, I'm intrigued, but I'll have to call
you later. It's been a beautiful process, I have to say. And like I said, I feel very privileged to be the person who has the opportunity to speak with everybody. And I've reconnected with a lot of people that I had not been connected with in a long, long time. So
That's good. It's nice, especially in this stage of our life to, like I said, be connected. I think we're connected Facebook-wise too, but we don't really talk too much. But I'm on the fringe of that group because of Joe, and I get to see a lot of stuff because I'm friends with Joe, and I'm friends with Johnny Bagans too. And Johnny Bagans.
Everybody is friends with John. So yes. That's just the way it is.
I was friends. This is really cool. I was friends with Lisa Raven, but then she passed away, which that one blew my mind. That one totally blew my mind when she passed. Along with, I don't know if you know, what was Ellen's maiden? Ellen Donovan? She was a year behind us.
Yes, Ellen Donovan. Yes. She lived over on 222nd Street.
Yeah. And when she passed, that blew, because I used to hang out with her and Annie McNeely when I was in my early 20s after my dad passed. And that one blew me. When people younger than me start dying, that's another one that just blows you away. But, yes. Michael Worrell killed me because I used to talk to a lot. Michael Worrell saved me through eighth grade.
Okay.
He and I sat in the back of the room. Garbus failed the four boy, me, three boys and me that sat in the back. All of us failed English in the fourth quarter. I was going to high school. I was in a remedial English class for about 5 minutes when the teacher realized I shouldn't have been there.
Wow.
But she hated us so much. That's what I'm saying, the brutality of it. The fourth quarter, because we used to sit in the back of the room and laugh all the time. And Michael Worrell, I didn't even know he was ill until he passed. I used to trade jokes with him and stuff all the time. He'd be up in the middle of the night and I'd go, Michael, you're making me laugh. I'd get up in the morning and read what he'd say. And I'd go, you just make me laugh, Michael. I had no idea he was sick. And that death bothered me too a lot because I just always thought I'd have him to do jokes off of me. He used to get some of the greatest jokes.
Yes. Yes.
But it's nice that you're doing this, as far as getting people together. And I can't wait to see the project. So thank you for including me in it, Michael.
My pleasure. Thanks for participating. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Thanks.